This is day five at the 58th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our first period speaker is Brother David Stiles on Lessons from David's Life. The subtitle for today's talk is Little Ones Who Were Leaders. This is the fifth talk in his series. The introductory reading is 2 Samuel 20, verses 14 to 26. Brother David.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Oh, wait, did I turn it on? Turn it on. Oh, boy. Oh, the whole thing's gone dark. Oh, I turned it off.
Hello. Thought I turned it on, I turned it off. Yes. Sometimes the simplest things in life can be quite, you know, difficult. Anyway, good morning. I hope everyone had a decent night's sleep. Apparently I snored quite loudly last night. Those sharing the apartment with me were not happy. My apologies. Hope no one else heard me. At any rate, you know, there's a life with a snorer, entertaining. Good to see you all, and you know, of course, a week at Bible camp can be joyous, wonderful, and uplifting, and also very taxing physically. So you know, maybe we're all looking forward to wrapping things up and getting back to our normal routines, which for some reason always seem more restful than a time away. But at any rate, I'm enjoying myself, and so far I think it's gone quite well. And to the best of my knowledge, the youthful shenanigans that go on up the hill have been at least containable. So that's always good. It's always a definition of a successful Bible school, Bible camp, that the teenagers haven't completely blown it up. a couple of bookkeeping duties. Sister Mary left these handouts up here, which are, right, sugar? Good? Yeah, and help yourselves, correct? All right, there you go. So, that's good. Anyway, I'm happy to report that Brother Asa did not approach me at any point yesterday and accuse me of being a good-for-nothing, you know, dirty lying scoundrel. So, that was good. I guess I was reasonably accurate in everything I said. Met with Ace's approval. Always good. However, this group, these Brits, are consistently trouncing me at Peruto. Honestly, I'm not, you know, they take it so seriously. I mean, it's a bit of a dumb game to begin with. And they're just, ooh. If you know Peruto, you roll the dice and you study it intently. The Kirks are another bunch of cutthroats. and they're like, move it along. We're going to have to go to bed and I'm tired and I'm cranky. And you guys are like, ooh, Peruto. and it has its own, what's that?
You're always first at the table.
Well, I'm there for the fellowship, Henry. It has its own vocabulary, like calzone and palafico, and you got to sing palafico. Ugh, doing my head in. And at any rate, you know, I'm trying to be lighthearted about it all. Wish they were. I've been talking to you about where I live in Amaranth. We talked about Amaranth actually being in the Bible. It means unfading. It's the word used to describe our unfading hope in Peter. And I was talking to someone about Amaranth, who was it? And they reckoned that their soil was too dry and poor to, you know, allow Amaranth to kind of turn into the full-blown monster that it can be. Who was telling me that? That it's actually edible, you can eat it. I forget. No, no confessions. Anyway, pardon? No, maybe it was a South African I was talking to. Of course, they have all kinds of interesting soil over there. At any rate, in my garden, amaranth, if left unpulled, turns into a monstrous plant, like absolute monster. And I often think it's very much like the mustard seed, you know, that grows into this gigantic plant. Amaranth is the plant is a source of the amaranth seed, which gives you amaranth flower. And I don't know about you guys, but we're regularly beset by, you know, information as to what is the next superfood. We have a Swiss German sister in our ecclesia who's very much given to eating very healthily. At least she preaches it, but we've also found out she cheats too. So we always say, oh, Irene's going to bang on about this and bang on about that. And then you find out she absolutely is given over to, you know, not a very good diet. But at any rate, we love her. And we forbear. Every now and then I'm like, Irene, stop it. But at any rate, amaranth, yes.
You know these recordings are going out, eh?
Oh, don't worry. Irene will be quite chuffed that she got mentioned, trust me. When you're German, there's no such thing as bad publicity. we're quite used to it, and we quite enjoy the attention. We're also very defensive. So has anyone ever seen an amaranth seed? Ever seen it? Yes. Okay. Yeah, millions, and they're tiny, tiny little hard seeds. They produce an oil, and you can turn it into flour. And I did one time get pasta made out of amaranth flour. It was the most appalling stuff I've ever tasted. And when you cooked it and tried to use it as pasta, it turned into a gray, gooey mess. So if you want to ingest amaranth, do not get the pasta. That ended quite badly. But nonetheless, it is quite a healthful, proteinaceous seed. It is very good for you. And interestingly, this tiny little seed, which is quite oily, will sit in the ground forever. And as soon as you disturb the soil, it stimulates it to sprout. So this tiny little black seed is really quite an amazing little natural allegory about eternity. It does not perish. Now, if you're a gardener, you hate it for that reason. If you're looking at things spiritually, you think it's an amazing, you know, lesson. But once you disturb it, it sprouts. And the trick is that over the summer to absolutely remove every single plant before it goes to seed, right? Now, I consider myself an assiduous gardener, but even I, by the end of August, I'm tapping out because you've just spent all summer long slogging away and you're like, you know what, maybe winter isn't so bad after all. And invariably, I let it go to seed. And I basically repopulated my garden soil with just untold millions of these tiny little monsters. But that's amaranth. It's a fascinating plant. It's very much like, you know, I said, that mustard seed, which grows into a massive plant. So that's amaranth. Anyway, let's press on. We got a lot to cover today. And today we're going to look at little ones who were leaders. It's a little bit of a deceptive title. The reason I call them little ones is because they were not aspirational in their desire to take over and lead. These were individuals who were able to stay in their lane and serve in the capacity they found themselves in. So they were giants of faith, but they would definitely have been perceived as little in the eyes of their contemporaries. And they did not consider power and control a thing to be desired, and hence they are standout examples of how we can behave and exercise our inclinations and spirituality and desire to serve in our own context. So, and I did include Jonathan in this list. In many respects, we see Jonathan as, he was had great status in the nation as the son of the king. But I did have a class wholly devoted to Jonathan. But my last class is on David and the Gentiles. So I thought, you know what? If we have time, we're going to have a look at him. But, you know, he's one of those Bible characters of which you cannot find anything to criticize. The man did not put a foot wrong during his life, and it was sadly cut short. So the first person we want to look at is Ittai the Gittite. Now, I don't know if you recall there's a lot of names in the Bible. And I know that sometimes those of us who grew up in maybe more conservative ecclesias got beat over the head with the meanings of names. A person Mansfield was famous for stringing together sentences out of the meanings of all the names. And, after a while, it does kind of start doing your head in. So you might feel like, oh, I just really don't want to pay attention to names anymore. Suffice it to say that very often a name will provide us with some very important information about the person. And in this instance, that is true of Ittai, because Ittai is a Gittite. And a Gittite is someone from Gath. And when we read the story of Ittai, where he appears in the record, he has apparently recently arrived from Gath. Ittai is, in fact, a Gentile convert. And when we look at Uriah, we'll find out he's a Hittite, obviously, also a Gentile convert to the hope of Israel. And, this is really one of those very interesting situations. We touched on it in the class about David, and that is David's connectedness to parties that you would consider to be anathema to any Jew or any Israelite. I pointed out how David quite readily fled to Gath. He eventually forged a very close friendship with Achish, even though some of his activities had to be suppressed. As you recall, David was actually going against the friends of the Philistines and the enemies of the Jews, the Israelites. He actually told him the opposite, so at any rate, we recall how Achish wanted to take David into battle against Saul. David was going to do it, except almost by divine intervention, David was, removed from the situation. So, that's, the story for the previous day. But it's evident that while David was, he spent a year in the land of the Philistines, and remarkably enough, a lot of the Philistines who had contact with David were converted to the hope of Israel. Now, you might say to me, Dave, I don't read any express statement that was in fact what happened. How do we know David wasn't just an effective military leader and they liked his style and they're like, right, David wins more than he loses. We're a warrior nation. The Philistines were very warlike. They excelled at war, so they were formidable opponents. So, you might suggest to me, maybe, this is a bridge too far to suggest they were converts, is reading something into the narrative that isn't there. My suggestion is that it's a reasonable conclusion to make that for the Philistines to leave what would have been, their home environment, their home culture. The Philistine culture was very distinct. It was very different to the Canaanitish culture. They worshiped Dagon, the half-fish god. They were different people. They were a different ethnicity. They spoke a different language. So for them to disrupt their lives and join David had to represent a very, big commitment on their part. And it is evident from the interchange that David has with Ittai, that this man brought with him not only 600 Gittites, but a whole lot of commitment to the man David. And so he shows up in the record when David is fleeing the city, and this is in 2 Samuel 15. So the king set out with all the people following him. They halted at the edge of the city. All his men marched past him, along with the Cherethites and Pelethites. These were Philistines. And all the 600 Gittites who had accompanied him from Gath, marched before the king. The king said to Ittai the Gittite, "Why should you come along with us? Go back and stay with King Absalom. You are a foreigner, an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday, and today shall I make you wander about with us. When I do not know where I am going, go back and take your people with you. May the Lord show you kindness and faithfulness." Very much a Ruth and Naomi moment here. Really fascinating stuff. But Ittai replied to the king, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death," sorry. Well, he made it yesterday, today. He says, I wonder how me crying will come through in the recording. People might think I've expired. Oh, no, he's still alive. I'm still alive. "There will your servant be." Now, that's just an incredible confession of faith. To me, that's a convert. That's not just some dude who's like, "Hey, bro, I like your moves." This man believed, and he wasn't going to go anywhere. He was staying attached to the one he knew was the true king. And David even references Absalom as the king. You know, go back, serve the king. Because, you know, David wasn't sure just exactly how this was going to play out. So, you know, to me, Ittai is this, David says, you're a foreigner. You're an exile. You're an outlier. You know, this isn't your home. This disadvantages you. And yet, you know, you're here. And that's an incredible testament to Ittai's leadership, his faith, and his commitment. And, you know, I think when we, you know, step back and we kind of create these, you might say, and don't take me the wrong way, but we kind of take biblical stories and turn them into a mythologized narrative. Do you know what I mean by that? We kind of create maybe a storyline that isn't quite there. And one of the storylines we create is Israel in the wilderness. This is the ecclesia in the wilderness. And God was isolating it from the world. We should be isolated from the world. Here's this ecclesia. And it was so wonderful. And it was all them. And it was just them. And it was God's way of just making it them. That is, all right, forgive me. It's complete bollocks, utter bollocks. Israel in the wilderness was a higgledy-piggledy mess of unfaithfulness. More often than not, they were completely going sideways. They disbelieved constantly. And the law, God, that was a hammer. God was just like taking a law, boom, right on the head. You unfaithful, misbehaved lot. You want to know what I want out of you? Here's a law. Slam. That was, you know, God was using tough love through the wilderness and intervened on occasion and knocked a bunch of them off for their ridiculous behavior. This was not this, you know, pretty picture. It was a mess. So the idea was, this is like, oh, protecting all the faithful is, you know, for us to ever cite that example is a reason to strengthen the things that remain so that we are pure and we, you know, don't have contact with the wider world is the complete antithesis of what's happening here. I mean, who came to the camp and gave Moses good advice? It was his Midianite father-in-law. That's who came and gave him good advice. They were in regular contact with people. You think they moved through the wilderness and never saw anybody? This was a heavily populated part of the world. I mean, well, it was the Amalekites who tried to pick him off on their way into Egypt. So this is, you know, and if you're like offended, I'm sorry, you know, come to me afterwards. I've got thick skin. But that this was all meant to be a closed shop is not true. Is not true. And built into the law, God was constantly admonishing them to have a favorable attitude to foreigners. Do not be prejudicial. Don't be racist. Don't be exclusionary. Don't be afraid of someone coming your way who doesn't look like you, talk like you, sound like you. You treat them right. And you let them in. And Ittai was welcomed with open arms by David. Interestingly, no evidence that Saul had these, you know, kind of individuals in his camp. But David certainly did. And Ittai was just this kind of individual. He was a Gentile from the hot and burning center of hatred for the people of God, the Philistines, and saw something better, and he grabbed it. And David welcomed him, and he was an incredible example of faithfulness to God's anointed when the rest of Israel was showing fickleness and poor judgment. And likewise, we got the example of Uriah the Hittite. You know, why he was there, where he came from, you know, we don't know exactly, other than the fact that by being called a Hittite, we know he was not a Jew. Now, do you remember what God said to Israel when he said, look, I'm going to send you into the land and you're going to wipe out the inhabitants? What did God say to Israel? He said, if you don't do it, there'll be a consequence. And what's the consequence? Yeah, I'm going to leave them. I'll help you. I'll facilitate the process. But if you drop the ball, my offer of help is over. Now you got a deal. And I'm going to leave him. I'm going to leave him as a thorn in your side. You know, it's right back to the wheat and the tares. God said, you know, I'll help you pull some of the weeds. But if you don't, you know, put your back to it, I'm going to be that gardener. I'm walking away. You're going to sort it. That's exactly what happened to Israel. They had to sort it. They had to deal with it. And, you know, we often think, oh, you know, let's get it pure. Let's clean it up. Let's remove any, you know, kind of evidence that we live in a wider world, you know. That God said, no, you have to cope with these inhabitants and everything they represent. You know, we talk about how bad it is out there. You know what it was like to have a Canaanitish city, you know, within, you know, eyeball distance of where you lived. You know what they did? We know what they did. You worried about your neighbor cranking music on the weekend and maybe breaking out the brewskis and getting a bit tipsy and leaning over the fence and wanting to have an over-friendly chat with you? You think, oh, it's the world, you know, so bad. That's nothing. The Canaanites were indulging in their lascivious forms of worship. They were burning their babies in fire. They were carrying on in a way that was beyond comprehension. We have no idea what it was like for the Israelites to witness this. And God said, you're going to deal with that. Oh my goodness. If we want to get to the real grunge, we have to go to certain corners of the city and seek it out. But go look for it. They didn't have to go look for it. Backyard. So in all likelihood, this Uriah the Hittite was that guy who maybe looked around and said, these Israelites, they're not perfect, but they ain't doing what's going on over here, and I'm getting sick of that. So Uriah converted. He came in, and he married high. He married high in the land. He married the daughter of Eliab, the granddaughter of Ahithophel. Uriah did real well for himself. I mean, undoubtedly because he was an exemplary individual, and we know him to be an exemplary individual. We know he was a courageous warrior. He was one of David's mighty men. And in the end, it was so sad, and I'm quite certain, you know, based on what we know about David, that to the day he died, he didn't quit thinking about what happened to this, what he did to Uriah. Such a good man. And he got murdered. Got murdered by a man who should have looked after him. And, you know, I don't want to dwell on that point over much, because we know David to be a man after God's own heart. You know, he was able to course correct and recover from such a terrible situation. But the simple fact is, brethren and sisters, you know, when we're looking at the ecclesia, when we're looking at what our role is, you know, how do we act as leaders, the most important role of leadership is nurturing one another, looking after one another. And honestly, no sooner do you get a group form when they're ins and outs. There's the others, the ones we might not come with, you know, the right backstory or, you know, aren't fully connected to everyone. You know, someone was, you know, commenting to me that, you know, sometimes when you don't have a Christadelphian background, it's very difficult to come to a situation like this. And everyone asks, oh, do you know so-and-so? Oh, you're from here. Do you know that one? Do you know this one? They're like, mate, I don't know anybody. I just showed up. You know, I quit asking me. And you know, we think it's nice. You know, we think, oh, you know, let's find some common ground. But to someone who's recently arrived, you know, it makes them feel very much like not a part of the group. So, you know, word to the wise, and I do it too. Sorry, whoever I've upset. But it's easy done. But what it does is, you know, we have to be conscious of the fact that individuals who come to us without strong connections or a strong background in faith and religion can feel very quickly like an outlier. And that is the last thing in the world they should be made to feel. You know, if maybe the first topic of conversation shouldn't be common acquaintances, when, you know, if you were remotely thoughtful, we would realize there weren't any. You know, I don't know, talk about Man United. There's plenty out there. And that's a feel-good story. Feel-good story for a Liverpool fan. Sorry for the non-football fans in our midst. Hope you don't feel like an outlier. So, Uriah deserved better than what he got. And there's one thing that Uriah says, which, you know, to me is such an incredible attestation of faith, is that, you know, when David tries to coax him to going home, and, you know, and David must have realized what he was saying, and under normal circumstances, David would have applauded Uriah's sentiments. Uriah said in verse 11 of chapter 11, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my commander Joab and my Lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go into my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. Now that was, what does Uriah say that is so telling in that verse? He says something incredibly telling about what he believed to be the hope of the righteous. He says something. You pick it up?
Dwelling in booths.
Dwelling in booths. Israel and Judah, now the ark was in a tent set up by David. We're going to look at that tomorrow. But Israel and Judah weren't in tents. They were in homes. They were in cities. They were in villages. Why did Uriah describe everyone as living in a tent? Because he recognized this wasn't it. It wasn't the rest that God had promised. He looked forward to a better day. He wasn't content with what was. What you know was the case then. He saw something in the future. They had a hope of a life everlasting and the resurrection. That was Uriah, and David knew it. David knew what he was saying. And in that moment in time, David was probably hoping, Uriah, I wish we weren't quite so devout and faithful, because, you know, it's messing with my plan. But that was the man, Uriah. He believed in the hope of the resurrection. Pretty powerful stuff. And, you know, he gets mentioned in the genealogy in Matthew 1, 5 to 6. You know, Bathsheba, who had been the wife of Uriah. Pretty fantastic. All right, let's move on before I completely come apart. Okay, Abigail, there's two women in the list that I want to consider. And how are we doing for time? Anybody?
Reasonable.
Oh, thanks, Gordon. You're. What's that? And what do I get to go to? Oh, all right. 20 minutes. All right. Sorry. No. I'm in. and sensitive about a lot of things, and one of them is time. All right, Abigail. Abigail, we know to be a godly woman in trying circumstances. She endured a difficult marriage without becoming resentful or bitter, and she was prepared to meet David, knowing he was in an inflamed state of mind, followed by an armed contingent, intent on mayhem, and provided wise counsel. She was not intimidated by David standing in the nation. She knew who he was. Nabal knew who he was. They all knew who David was. And she said, right, this thing has gone absolutely sideways, and it's due to my husband, who is rightly named a fool. So, you know, you look at what Abigail did when circumstances presented it. And, you know, we often cast about for things we can do. How can I, you know, contribute to my ecclesia? How can I be a force for good? How can I, you know, be counted in that day as someone who labored in the vineyard? Abigail's, you know, most of Abigail's laboring to that point in time in her life had been to sustain herself in trying circumstances. That's what Abigail did. Without becoming embittered or beat down by a man who must have been very, you know, unpleasant to live with. He was, you know, everyone, and everyone agreed with it. His servants did. You know what he's like. He's impossible. So that was what Abigail was like. She carried on. And when the day came to make a difference, Abigail was there. It wasn't every day in Abigail's life she could make a difference, but when the time came, she made herself available, and she took the initiative, and she wasn't intimidated. She made good choices, and you compare this to someone like Ishbosheth, who was intimidated and bullied by stronger personalities and made terrible choices that were destructive and horrible. Not Abigail. And when she did approach David, and we don't have time to read through that whole account, she said, forgive the trespass of your handmaid. You know, she was way, you know, kind of way outside kind of what was meant to be or how it should have been. Nabal, you know, hey, Nabal owned it all. It was his stuff. He was the one who refused to give it over. Who was she to, you know, take it and give it? But she's like, you know what? He's made a horrible choice. I'm going to undo this choice. I'm going to step up. And she did. And she recognized it. She said, look, forgive this trespass. She was certainly familiar with David's exploits. She knew he was going to be anointed to be king over Israel. And she took the blame for Nabal's decision. You know, let this fall on me. I'll take responsibility for this. I mean, this is not someone who was going to pass the buck. That's leadership. That's leadership. You take responsibility for what's happening. You try to make it better. You know, you look at the prayers of the faithful, you know, the prayer of Ezra, the prayer of Nehemiah, the prayer of Daniel. They did not distance themselves from what was happening around them. They did not avoid responsibility, even though it wasn't their immediate problem or due to their, you know, behavior. But they certainly weren't going to, you know, step back and say, oh, that's that guy, not me. No one ever, you know, the faithful men and women don't look at life and find ways of avoiding accountability. You know, what's the, how do you solve a problem? Not by running from it, you run into it. You know, what do they say when there's an explosion? Run through the flames, not away from the flames. Fortunately, I've never had to do that yet. But, you know, it's a valuable life lesson. When confronted with potential catastrophic consequences, run into the fire. You're going to be able to, you know, get through it much more effectively than trying to distance yourself from it. And when you do that, you know, be able to take on board what's going on and recognize that, hey, you know, I'm a part of this. This is, you know, my ecclesia. This is my community. This is my family. This is my marriage. You know, don't, you know, just take it on board and you know, try to affect better circumstances for everyone involved. And of course, we recognize that, you know, Abigail consistently uses this expression, handmaid. I'm your handmaid. And of course, that has powerful echoes in the Psalms. And of course, with Mary herself, I'm the handmaid. So Abigail, you know, whether she understood the full import of that expression, you know, knowing what we know about her, I have to think that Abigail recognized that that particular expression, the handmaid, she was, you know, bringing David's attention, drawing David's attention to something much higher than the current circumstances, and that was God's promise to about the seed of the woman, the promises to the fathers, and David had not yet received the promise of the son to sit on the throne. But I think Abigail was an incredibly plugged-in woman, had a thoroughgoing knowledge of the hope and the promises God had made, and was prepared to exercise important and powerful leadership when circumstances demanded it. And she was certainly comfortable stepping outside whatever social conventions existed at the time and doing what was right. So to me, Abigail stands out as a powerful example of a person, you know, who may have been considered little in exercising strong leadership. And then, and this was the reading we read, this was the wise woman of Abel Beth Maacah. And not named, but not forgotten. So as the reading indicated, when this Sheba, son of Bichri, is leading a rebellion shortly after David had returned to Jerusalem, she's the one who steps up, saves the city, and stops the whole thing from turning into a bigger disaster than what it was already. And just a couple details to look at in respect to what exactly it was that was going on. Because after everything that had happened with Absalom, the defeat of Absalom, David returning, being welcomed with open arms, you can't imagine how was it that this Sheba, the son of Bichri, was able to gain traction and to start this rebellion all over again. Like, wasn't everyone tired of it all? And yet apparently there was a group that wasn't. And there is a clue as to what was going on. When David, when Joab says to her, when he's, you know, explaining, you know, what it was he was doing. So in verse 20, far be it from me, Joab replied, far be it from me to swallow up or destroy. That is not the case. A man named Sheba, son of Bichri, from the hill country of Ephraim, has lifted up his hand against the king, against David. Hand over this man and I'll withdraw from the city. That's a bit curious, because Sheba was a Benjamite. But Joab describes him as from the hill country of Ephraim, right? Why that? Why reference his association with the hill country of Ephraim? Well, what was Ephraim in Israel? Well, Ephraim was the second most powerful tribe. And it had been a leader for a long time. Joshua was an Ephraimite. Ephraim was a son blessed above Manasseh. Ephraim enjoyed status in the nation as a leading tribe. And my suggestion is there was a party in Ephraim that it was jealous of Judah's role. And David, being from Judah, had, you know, Judah had attained an ascendancy that no other tribe could compete with. I think there was a group in Ephraim, a group of leadership, that was, you know, collaborating with the malcontents in Benjamin to cause David grief. And they just about did it. But to me, that speaks of this, you know, spirit of resentment and discontent that was always simmering under the surface, even when things, you know, were going relatively well. And I find that quite fascinating about, you know, the dynamic that we see in Israel throughout its history and eventually exploded at the end of Solomon's reign and the kingdom was divided permanently. They all struggled to get along. Even when a good man like David was at the helm, there was always that group who bubbled away under the surface, never happy, always feeling like they got short shrift, always feeling like they've been reduced to second best and they wanted to be top dog. So maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. I do find it suggestive that this Benjamite is described as from the hill country of Ephraim. So he's on the run. He had overreached. Joab was hot on his trail after his rather gory dispatchment of Amasa. And they end up, do you know where this Abel Beth Maach is?
No.
Should have it on a map. Anyway, way up high, right at the top of the of Israel. And do you, anyone remember who was occupying that area way up north?
Dan
actually was split between two areas. This was a portion of the Danites' inheritance, which they acquired by, remember when they were moving through looking for more land and they stumbled across Micah and his like teraphim and image, and they stole it all, and they stole his like Levite, kidnapped the Levite. Actually, he was happy to go along because why not be a priest over a tribe than just this guy Micah, the grandson of Moses, as it turned out. So there was this, you know, the Danites way up north, kind of lived their own life, you know, quite a little autonomous area. Well, that's where Sheba fled to in hopes of escaping, and he goes into one of these cities way up there and, you know, thought he might get some kind of relief or support or protection from this group of Israelites that were kind of living their own life, doing their own thing. I don't know. Anyway, what Sheba didn't count on was this woman, because Joab was on the verge of pulling the city apart brick by brick. They were done. Joab was done, and understandably so. Anyway, here's this old, you know, this lady. She's listening. Anybody gonna do anything? Joab is going to wipe us out. And you idiots have let this guy in. So she said, right, I'm gonna walk to the edge of the wall. Calls out to Joab. Joab, I want you to listen to me. Oh, okay. Well, this is why I'm here. She goes, why are you doing this? Why are you destroying us? This is our inheritance. Don't do this. Don't extinguish this in Israel. It's against the law, and it was. It was God's intent that they retain their inheritance until things changed. It was a lesson in eternity. She understood all this. She said, what do you want? Tell me what you want. Because I want Sheba's head. No problem. I'll get you the head. Goes back, says to the blokes behind her who are, give me the head. They went and got the head. Goes, throw it over the wall. And there's old Sheba's head. Boom. At Joab's feet. Joab goes, oh, thank you very much. Bye. I don't know. Times were tougher back then. A little bit of home kill going on there. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, Sheba made bad choices, that one did. And he crossed the wrong lady. You know, we talk about, you know, leadership and you know, how we interact with one another. And we rightly emphasize grace, mercy, love, compassion, gentleness, you know, meekness, you know, qualities that we rightfully identify as desirable. But there is the time and place to cut a head off. And very often, the heads we cut off aren't the right ones. You know, we cut the wrong head off, and we leave the guy whose head should be cut off standing. And, you know, it takes a wise woman to discern the difference. And honestly, I, you know, we've just had a conversation about this last night about our current ecclesial structures, and it's, let's be honest, it's male dominated. I consider that to be a mistake. I think we need to rethink it. I think we need to redo it. We need to reboot it.
We are not Presbyterians. We do, you know, did not need to adopt their organizational structures, because that's exactly what Robert Roberts rebooted when he did the Ecclesial Guide. It's what we got. It's what we inherited. But it creates imbalance. Our sisters don't have the voices they should have. And very often we find that embedded in our sisters is a wisdom and a spirit of discernment that, as men, we're not privy to. Okay? We're blunt instruments, us blokes. And we certainly are inclined to act before we think. And we got a little problem. It's called testosterone. And it creates proclivities in the male mentality that a woman doesn't have to be burdened with. And very often, you know, we talk about woman's intuition and all the rest. I know there's a lot of cliches. But this woman's wisdom was rooted in spiritual priorities. It was rooted in the Word of God, and she was prepared to exercise that wisdom when it needed to be. And no one shut her down. That was so important. No one shut her down. They listened to her. And everyone, you know, walked away much happier than they had been 5 minutes earlier. And the only guy who, you know, had an unfortunate end to the story was Sheba, who, you know, shouldn't have done what he did. So, you know, this wise woman, she has a small role in the Bible, but I think she, you know, it's a disproportionate message and exhortation to us all. And then finally, I just want to touch far too briefly on Jonathan. He is the friend that sticketh closer than a brother. And, what is it about Jonathan that we don't know or don't appreciate? I hope almost nothing. I don't know how he was able to work through all the family baggage he had inherited. And it was a lot. He had inherited tribal baggage. He inherited family baggage. And he found himself in a role that nobody in his family ever expected to play. Saul didn't, and certainly his sons didn't. We know what happened to Saul. What was not an aspiration became a source of intense desire for Saul, the power, the control, always searching for respect that in the end he never got. Everything that Saul liked about the kingship were the wrong things. Jonathan was the complete antithesis to that. Everything about a position of leadership, Jonathan, you know, recognized how he could best function in it as opposed to absolutely making it, you know, disastrous. And he tried to rein his father in. Absolutely, you know, it was a challenge that was beyond Jonathan. But the fact was he attempted to do it while at the same time respecting his father's integrity and role in the nation. That is such a difficult line to draw in your life. It's such a difficult thing to balance. And Jonathan did it with grace and love. And you might say, well, Jonathan, you know, you failed in the end. You died on the mountains of Gilboa. Your father led the nation into disaster. You seemed impotent to stop it. Why not, you know, do what no one else would do and say, right, Dad, I'm going to, you know, commit you to an insane asylum. You're done. Wouldn't do it. He let, you know, he did what he could within the bounds of what he could do. And then he let the rest play out. And, you know, one thing that distinguished Jonathan from his father and was very similar to David was his love of the people. When that whole situation played out where Saul swore an oath, don't eat, you know, Jonathan looked around and said, you know, how much greater a victory could we have won? My father had not made this foolish oath. And yet Jonathan was prepared to accept the consequence of having broken it. He wasn't going to lift a hand in his own defense. I mean, the man was incredible. And so full of a spirit that, you know, I aspire to. I can't say that I'm there, not even close. And his acceptance of David as God's anointed, he gave it all over and said, I'll help you. I'll help you be king. I want to be by your side and make this better for everybody. Like, who says that? Walk away, give it up. That's Jonathan. And
that's a conflict of interest, like, oh, you just can never
can't conceive of it. Can't conceive of it. And you know, one thing Jonathan was not going to let intrude itself, is his rights. I got rights. You know, you're trotting on my inheritance. You know, who are you, David? You know, remember, David was not, you know, a natural pick in anybody's book. You know, there was something about David that kind of had him over here. So along comes the shepherd kid or guy whose own family kind of had issues with. His own brothers were very antagonistic to. You know, he comes along and, you know, you might ask yourself, why didn't Jonathan kill Goliath? You know, Jonathan was a great man of faith. Jonathan was full of courage. Jonathan was, you know, just as much devoted to the things of Israel and God as David. Interestingly, Jonathan didn't do it.
He wasn't a man of Judah, though.
He wasn't a man of Judah. I tend to agree with you, Mary. I think Jonathan recognized, particularly after that disaster, you know, when Saul was going to kill him because he, you know, ate the honey, you know, he must have thought, you know what, I got to be very careful how I manage my father. Not to mention one of the rewards was marrying Saul's daughter, so I'm pretty sure Jonathan didn't want to marry his sister. So at any rate, Jonathan, for whatever reason, did not put himself forward at that moment and in that time to save Israel from the giant. But when David does it, Jonathan loves it. And loves the man, and loves what he did. And, you know, absolutely applauded David's prowess and strength and leadership. That is so hard to do. To have somebody come along who outshines you, who appears to be better than, and to have done greater things, and to step aside and say, hey, that's awesome, you know, let's be mates. What were the disciples and apostles arguing about at the Last Supper? Who was going to be greatest in the kingdom? They were so stuck on who was going to be greatest. I mean, godly men, but oh my goodness. You know, Jesus keeps telling you, I'm going to be crucified soon. Oh, by the way, Lord, who's going to be greatest? I'm going to die. Oh, by the way, Lord, who's going to be greatest? Somebody's going to betray me. Oh, by the way, is it me? Oh, if it's not, who's going to be greatest? I mean, good guys, but stuck. And it's easy to get stuck there. And what's so powerful about Jonathan's example is he didn't get stuck there. He didn't go there. He didn't get close to there. He loved godliness for godliness' sake, wherever it came from. And David was that man who he loved dearly, more than the love of women. Thank you for your kind attention.